Welcome to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea Reedy. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today is all about bees. Well, I should say all about Melanie Kirby and her journey to become an apiculturist, queen honeybee breeder, researcher, writer, educator, and artist. Kirby is a native New Mexican and member of Southern New Mexico's Tortugas Pueblo. After completing her undergraduate degree from St. John's College in Santa Fe, she enlisted as a volunteer in the U.S. Peace Corps, where she was assigned beekeeping and stationed in Paraguay for over 2 years. Colette LaBeouf talks with Kirby about how her work with bees got started.
We want to talk about bees today and your love for bees, and you're an apiculturist. And for our audiences, can you define that?
Sure. So an apiculturist is one who works with bees and studies bees, akin to a beekeeper. So that's definitely part of the definition. And I also study them. I also collaborate with them and learn so very, very much from them. So it's definitely, as apiculturist sort of contains within itself, it's a culture, so to speak. And it's also, it includes that as well, the study of cultures and their interaction with bees and beekeeping.
And how did you come to bees?
I came to bees by assignment, as I like to say. My mother had been a Peace Corps volunteer way back when. So my youth, I grew up hearing about it, just her mentioning, you know, in conversation with folks that it was one of the best things she'd ever done. And she'd also met my father down there. And when she was finished with her service, she stayed an extra year and she met my father. So I'm of mixed heritage. I'm from here, from New Mexico, born and raised. And we're part of Tortugas Pueblo in southern New Mexico. But then I also have Caribbean influence. And the Caribbean influence also has European influence. And so my last name is actually Scottish-Irish, which you wouldn't think when you see me. I'm definitely a product of the American melting pot at this point. My mother's an educator, so she was very inspiring and encouraging that she wanted her children to at least learn more and to branch out. So I always knew that I wanted to get a degree, at least a bachelor's. I actually started in marine biology fisheries for a couple years, and growing up in southern New Mexico, which is very hot desert, I was very excited when I got a scholarship to University of Miami in Florida. And so I hit the beach for a couple of years, definitely coming of age years. And this was early 90s. And so I was a raver for a couple of years, and that's how I got into DJing. And so my plan had been, when I decided actually to come back and I ended up going to school, I switched gears and decided I really wasn't learning in the way that I had hoped to out there. Mm-hmm. I decided to regroup, and I moved back to New Mexico, and I went to St. John's College in Santa Fe. Yeah, and then from there, I knew afterwards my plan was to move to San Francisco and be a DJ, but I did Peace Corps, and that changed my whole life plan.
And so you went to Paraguay.
I was stationed in Paraguay for a little over 2 years.
How did you get the work that you got as a Peace Corps volunteer?
Good question. So this is where the assignment sort of part comes in. The U.S. Peace Corps is a part of the Cultural Affairs Division. And so they look for technicians who are willing to go abroad and share their experience. And so interestingly, when I had signed up for the Peace Corps, I mean, this was back in the good old Scantron days where you had to color in the bubbles. For those who don't know what Scantron is. And I remember coming across that question that said, do you mind working with stinging insects? And I literally thought, is this a trick question? And I thought, oh, well, I want to appear as flexible as possible. So I marked, no, I don't mind. You know, there were other questions like, do you mind living outdoors? Do you, you know, mind beep, beep in the woods, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I figured, you know, no, I'm ready for an adventure. I was really excited about it. So I marked that I did not mind. And the next thing you know, that was my actual assignment. So I was in the agriculture sector, and then I was designated as a beekeeping extensionist. And interestingly, you think you're going to go and share your, you know, experience with these communities, but I had no beekeeping experience. I knew nothing about beekeeping before I went, but I scoured what I could. And this was also right when internet was just getting started. So there weren't websites really yet. You know, I think AOL was the only thing that was just sort of taking off. So I did the good old fashioned you know, hoof work, and I went to the library and I looked up some books about beekeeping and I read them and I was like, oh, this will be interesting. We'll see how this goes. I really had never in my wildest dreams, like, thought that that would be not only something that they would assign me, but I mean, looking back now, that it's something I have done for a living. So, mm-hmm. So I was stationed actually in a community called Calle Mil in the departamento, or kind of like the state of Guayra, in a region that's called Colonia Independencia. So there was actually a lot of Germans after World War II who had moved out there. So it was very interesting to be in Guarani country because that's their indigenous background, but there were a lot of fair-haired, blue-eyed Paraguayans running around, which was interesting too.
And that's the language also? There's a indigenous language that they're speaking in that area you were in also?
Yes, so okay. It's called Guarani, and they also spoke a mix of it, kind of like we have with Spanglish, but there it's called Jopara. And so my Spanish was, it existed. I mean, I grew up in southern New Mexico. My mom's family speaks Spanish, but I wasn't really formally ever taught it. So I knew a little bit. And once I went down there, then I really learned it. Once you're in the capital city, a lot of people want to speak Spanish. And so I watched a lot of telenovelas, which really actually, those teach you the big fancy words. And then my community spoke mostly Guarani, but some Jopara. And interestingly, they even if they didn't speak Spanish, they understood it because same thing, they would watch the novelas.
So you get there and you go through your training, and then did you just fall in love with bees right away?
Well, you know, the bees there are very aggressive. They are stinging insects. And they're just more aggressive because in the 50s, there was Dr. Kerr, who was based in Brazil, had decided to bring in some strains from South Africa. And so over time, then those were accidentally, so they say, released and made their way up through, you know, the rest of South America and into Central America and now even into the U.S. and the southern portions of even our state have a presence of what they called Africanized bees. Mm-hmm. So it's Apis mellifera scutellata, and they are honeybees, so they can interbreed. You can't tell with the naked eye. They look just like every other honeybee, but okay. They are highly aggressive, defensive behavior. But highly pest disease resistant. So I think his intentions were not to encourage the aggressive aspect, but the productive and right. resistant aspect.
Right.
But it changed the world. Mm-hmm. So
interesting. So the DJ idea went away.
Well, it was interesting because I still have my turntables to this day, which I just reset up finally because they've been in storage over the years. And I mean, I got back. I still kind of dabbled in it a little bit, just more for myself. And then, I mean, I was never uber like mm-hmm. famous or anything like that, but I DJ'd when I was going to school at St. John's. And so that was fun. But that was prior to going. But yeah, so after I came back, I kind of really just became intrigued with not only insect and insect husbandry, but more importantly, international development and land-based cultures and sustainable food production. That really came more in the forefront to me as things I was, you know, you leave home, you kind of see a bigger picture in terms of what's happening at different places and what parallels there are with home and what things are different. And so it put me on that track more of going into farming. Mm-hmm. And so I had made a really good friend while I was in Peace Corps who was another volunteer, and she was a horticulturist, and she was from Hawaii. That's where she'd grown up. And her mother had come to visit, and we really hit it off. And so her mom said, well, when you girls are done traveling after your service, because we already had plans, we wanted to travel around, she said, well, I could use help on my gardenia farm. So after traveling around through Argentina, Uruguay, Venezuela, floating up the Amazon, all that sort of fun stuff. We had many adventures. But after that, I ended up going out to work in Hawaii, which, again, coming from, you know, a drier state, I was like, job? Hawaii? I'm there. So I went out there, and I ended up staying out there, actually, for a total of 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And while I was there, I worked for her gardenia farm, Carol Christensen's her name, on the Big Island of Hawaii. And while I was there, I actually then learned about some commercial queen rearing operations, which I had no idea.
So tell me what that is. What does that mean?
Yeah, so there are farms that are specifically focused on breeding bees. And I just didn't even know that there was that whole side to the industry. So I my initial experience was very rustic and, you know, out in what we called El Campo or the bush, using a machete, catching wild swarms, building equipment without power tools, making our own smokers, which is a little sort of canister that emits smoke to calm the bees. We even sewed our own veils for protective gear for our faces. And I went from that sort of experience to all of a sudden it was like factory farming USA. It was intense. It was actually very impressive how organized and detail-oriented all of it is, and all the pieces that go into it that make it work. It gave me the opportunity to work with beekeepers from all over the world who would come out there, because due to the climate, of course, they're able to rear queens year-round. So they would rear a bunch of queens in starting in what would be, you know, temperate climate winter all the way through spring. And it was anticipation for when spring hit here on the mainland, commercial beekeepers and other beekeepers would need new queens. Mm-hmm. And also for the Canadian market or all around the world. So the first place I worked at produced 35,000 queens a year. That was a Hawaiian queen. And it was owned by a very interesting gentleman named Michel Krohns. And he was actually, he's an Austrian who was born and raised in Argentina. But then he owned a honey company in Costa Rica for many years. And then he moved to Hawaii and wanted to get into queens. So I credit him with teaching me the process of grafting, which is transferring queen larvae. And there's no slicing and dicing involved. It's just literally transferring a little larva that's floating on royal jelly.
Moving it
into a different space so that then it can be reared into a queen. So I worked for him for a season, and then I switched over to Kona Queen, which is actually like the world's largest queen production farm. And they produce it's pretty close to 300,000 queens. So, you know, 10 times as many as the other guy. And but to put it in perspective, like I'm not even my own local production is less than a half a percent of what those guys produce. So, much smaller scale.
And that's Zia queen bees.
Zia queen bees, right.
So tell us about Zia queen bees and what you do there, because I know in addition to what you do with the bees, there's also education, outreach,
right,
all sorts of aspects to it.
So yeah, so once I was out there in Hawaii, it really opened my eyes to this sort of the industry at large, and I didn't realize there were so many different facets to it. You have the beekeepers, you have the farmers, of course, you have the bee producers, you have the bee breeders, you have the researchers, you have the honey producers, the honey packers, the honey distributors, the pollination services. So I had no idea just how multifaceted this industry was. And it's fascinating to learn about each one and the challenges and issues that each one has, because they are an ag commodity, so to speak. So they run into the same issues that any other, like the cattle livestock situation may have, or milk production or things like that.
That was Melanie Kirby, apiculturist and queen honeybee breeder of Zia Queen Bees, talking with Colette LaBeouf. Let's take a break. When we come back, more from Melanie about her work with bees.
In the park I was sleeping last night, I saw a vision true, coming over the broken land, an angel of light crying, and the tears fell from her cheeks into the cracks and healed the world. It was not a passing fancy, romance or poetry. It was a real and mighty thing, and it took my breath away. And underneath it all was slow.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. Let's pick up from where we left off hearing from Melanie Kirby. Kirby established Zia Queen Bees Farm and Field Institute in 2005, providing pollination services for diverse communities around northern New Mexico. In the earlier segment, Melanie described how her work with bees began in Paraguay while she was stationed there as a Peace Corps volunteer. She then worked for several beekeeping operations in Hawaii. Let's pick up the conversation from there.
I decided to move back to the mainland, and I actually worked in my hometown of Las Cruces for a little bit at NMSU in an office, and I was miserable because I did not want to be inside. I remember even like, I'll go pick onions. I just want to be outside. And there's big onion production down south, along with pecans and chili. And so I ended up, of course, now the internet is existing and growing and people are using it. And I happened to find a job in Florida of all places. So at this point, my beekeeping was really my experience was really subtropical, tropical oriented, you know, coming from Paraguay, which is subtropical, Hawaii, of course, is that, and then to Florida as well. I worked for a commercial beekeeper, a migratory operator named Gary Oreskovich, who's originally from Wisconsin. So he would move his bees between Wisconsin and Florida following certain blooms. It would allow him to make queens and reproduce more bees. And then he could also do different kinds of honey. So I learned a whole other side, and also from a much smaller outfit, but a more diversified outfit. And he was a very grumpy beekeeper, but extremely, extremely knowledgeable. And he made all of his own equipment. He milled and sawed all his own wood, put all of his equipment together. And he was just extremely conscientious in everything he did. And so I then had this experience of like, wow, from rustic to Factory Farm USA to all of a sudden like a smaller sort of family op, right? And so I got to see these differences in approaches and realized that, wow, I was, you know, I could glean a little bit from each place I worked to sort of create my own situation. Because there were things that I liked about each one, but there were definitely things that I didn't like about each one, or that I didn't think was respectful or sustainable. So, but while I was there, I met a beekeeper named Mark Spitzig, who's from Michigan. Mark had started off as a hobbyist beekeeper with just a couple hives, a couple packages of bees, and a couple friends and a couple books. And he, after a few years, he stuck with it, and the friends had decided they wanted, you know, they kind of lost interest. And so he went from two hives to five to 17 units of, he said he didn't know what. And they were swarming from the trees. This is in Upper Michigan in the UP, in the Upper Peninsula. And so he realized that he needed to, after about 5 years of that, and he would just sell his honey to the local co-op there, to the Marquette Food Co-op. He realized he liked it enough and wanted to know more, so he needed to go work for a professional. So he called this guy Gary, who he originally got his bees from, and ended up going to work for him. So I met him while I was working there, and we hit it off and we teamed up. And I actually, at that point in time too, because I had already then sort of traveled with beekeeping, I realized that it was also a skill that could take you around the world if you really wanted to. And I love traveling, especially from my Peace Corps experience. And so I actually had plans to go to New Zealand after. That was like my next gig was lined up in New Zealand. And so there's a lot of beekeepers, just like migrant farmers, who are in the northern hemisphere during our spring and summer months, and then they go to the southern hemisphere during our winter, but down there it's spring and summer. At any rate, so that was my plan, but I decided to go to Michigan instead, to Upper Michigan, and helped him run his honey production with my queen rearing skills from having been in Hawaii for, you know, 5 years. We were able to double his numbers, so he had 50 hives at the time, which starting from two, over 5 years later, he had 50, and we multiplied that by we were able to double them up. So we had 100. And I don't know what inspired me to think that it was going to be easy, nonetheless feasible. But I said, why don't we, instead of taking them to Florida, why not bring half to New Mexico?
Okay.
And I had never kept bees in my home state.
Because I was wondering, that was something I was wondering was, as this is happening, as you're learning more, was it in the back of your mind that you wanted to come home, bring this home, or?
I definitely knew that at some point I wanted to come home. Mm-hmm. And the more I was working with bees, I was seeing it as like, well, I really like this. And my mother, being a retired educator, now she's retired at the time, she wasn't, but she was like, are you going to do grad school? Are you going to do grad school? When are you going to do grad school? And so I remember thinking like, oh, I'll get to it. Like just a few years, you know, I'm learning so much. Plus, as I mentioned, I was still really kind of like international development, sustainable agriculture, anthropology. I wasn't sure exactly what subject or discipline I wanted to go into. So I hesitated to do it. And I think it worked out good in the end because, I mean, I don't want to jump too far forward, but things are much more interdisciplinary now, and I thrive in that. I think if I had done it back then, I would have been really sort of pigeonholed and probably like, you know, not very, mm-hmm. not very happy with the direction I'd gone. But I ended up, we teamed up. And so we used to take the bees between Michigan and Florida one season, but then we switched to New Mexico. And so we learned together how to keep bees here. And we were actually first stationed, I want to say stationed, but we first lived in Velarde. Mm-hmm. For about 3 years.
I was wondering where you started.
Yeah, okay. In Velarde right there. When I first got here, I had mentioned to him I had always wanted to live up in northern New Mexico, having gone to school in Santa Fe. And I also knew that just with the mountain landscape, we'd probably have a little bit more isolation or control over a breeding program. Whereas in the southern part of the state, there's actually an Africanized bee presence. So there's aggressive bees that, you know, I talked about the bees that kind of escaped out of South America. Well, as they come up Central America and into the southern states, at least into New Mexico, you know, the tail end of the Rockies come all the way through our state. And so they hit that and they went left and right. They went east and west. So they established really heavily in Arizona, Southern California, of course, Texas, and then into the southern states and all the way over to Georgia and Florida. And New Mexico, they came up a little bit. But they're not fully established, I would say, from Albuquerque up. And part of the reason for that now, too, is that we do have a lot more urban beekeepers who are actively managing and are more knowledgeable about genetics. So that's helped to kind of curb them getting any higher. But they're a tropical bee. They're a subtropical bee. So they don't do good in our mountains. They don't do good in cold weather. But along those lines, yeah, so we teamed up and we were in Velarde for 3 years and we ended up moving to Dixon right down the road for a season for a year. And then we were going to have our daughter, who's going to be 12 in a month. So time flies. And then we ended up moving up to Truchas by chance. We really wanted to stay in Dixon, but had trouble finding a place. And of course, with a new baby and first baby on the way, I kind of really, you know, I wanted things to be really nice, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're renting this sort of ramshackle little stucco covered adobe, which served well, but it wasn't gonna be a permanent home. And we were up in Truchas and we ended up being up there for 11 years. So I'm sharing that because little did we know at the time, but that sort of locational migration, that little nomadic sort of tour we did, really now is our everyday practice. And it gave us a taste of the different microclimates in each little part, because we have so many microclimates here. I mean, across the street, it's 1 degree. And right here, it's a different, depending whether you're in sun or shade. And of course, water access. And so we now do a 60-mile loop, just about, between the highlands and the lowlands. So in the spring, we'll have our hives, bring them down to the valley. And it's very similar to cattle's, or to livestock, I guess, cattle rotation. But we'll have them down in the lowlands in the spring when the fruit bloom is starting, and then the bosque blooms, and then come mid, late July or June, I should say, that's when we start to move them up to the mountains. It's kind of like they get a whole other spring up here. And then if the rains are good, then we can take them back down for a late summer flow.
So I'm so curious about when you, because I'm trying to imagine you moving these bees and
right.
And you're saying we. And so I'm wondering how many people is involved in...
Two people.
Okay.
That's it. Okay. But I mean, it was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So we did that extensively for just us two for, I'd say, 12 of the past 15 years. A few of those years, we've had interns. So we got to a point where we could host a couple interns. So we were in Truchas. We hosted our very first intern was a woman that I had met when I did a USAID farmer to farmer exchange. So I had done a couple volunteer tours as a volunteer tech trainer for USAID Farmer to Farmer program. So I had gone to Jamaica, was working with a family down there for a few months, and it was in the cold season, right? So our winter. And I met their intern. Her name is Kat, and she was from upstate New York, but she is a deaf beekeeper. So she does have an implant, but she rarely has it on. We hit it off, and she asked me if we ever hosted interns, and I said, we haven't yet, but
we should. Well,
we could use the help, that's for sure, because by then now I had two babies, mm-hmm. and my son had been born, so he was an infant at the time. I mean, we've never wanted to be large scale.
Okay.
And part of that is for a number of reasons. One is we want to have a positive ecological footprint. So we want our bees to be supportive, but we don't want them to oversaturate, right? Because there are lots of other bee species that need just as much space and forage and have just as much right to it as anybody else. And then the other thing, too, is just a matter of circumstance. We live in really challenging climate here. So we don't see large-scale beekeeping here because it's a really challenging place. So a lot of places where you are going to see that is where it's like the Central Valley of California, which is monocrop agriculture, you know, or other places that have already kind of been exploited for that sort of, you know, mm-hmm. massive ag. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't come from a family of beekeepers. Mark doesn't either. Nonetheless, farmers. So we really built everything out of pocket. We're still kind of hand to mouth in that respect. Because some years are good and some aren't so good. And, you know, beekeeping got very trendy and still is kind of trendy, which, to be honest, I used to really like it when my mother would introduce me to people and she'd say, oh, this is my daughter. She's a beekeeper. And people would hear bookkeeper and the conversation would go on. It was fine. And then it got to a point where I was like, oh, she's a beekeeper. And it's like, oh, your bees, what's going on with the bees? Why are they dying? What can we do? You know, and I was like, oh, my gosh. And a lot of people, those of us that work with bees or insects, like, for a living, you know, we tend to be, I'm an extrovert in that I like to chat it up, but it's also because I'm nervous. But we're very introspective. So when you kind of get put in a limelight situation like that, it can be overwhelming. And I, of course, was shy about it at first, but then I thought, you know, well, this is an opportunity to share and educate. And so that's what kind of encouraged me to start talking about bees and beekeeping more. I also had gotten a few grants through the Sustainable Ag Research Education. My whole vision is actually that within our own region, we can become our own reliable source for pollinators. And we can also create or designate ourselves as a preserve, a pollinator preserve. One thing I've learned about bees and beekeeping is that it's very interconnected to everything. So even though you think it's just bug on a flower and then a bug in a box and then, oh, I get to get honey from that box, there's this whole other, you know, matrix that's supporting that activity. And that has to do with land stewardship. It has to do with clean air, clean water. It has to do with policy and management and, you know, environmental protection. So it includes everything.
So this is going to just shift a little bit toward your decision, your choice to go back to school also,
right.
And how this interdisciplinary focus really interested you. And in that time, programs changed, mm-hmm. And weren't so maybe, like you said, to pigeonhole the study. Mm-hmm. But I'm so interested, too, because I want to hear about Spain and your study. Mm-hmm. I'm so interested, too, in listening to you talk, hearing how much of what you learned and what you did has to do with people moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though we're talking about bees, has to do with people moving bees, but also moving themselves. So tell us about graduate school.
Right. Yeah, no, and exactly that. I mean, it's that movement of cultures and how that brings about traditions, but also our movement within the landscape and how that affects other organisms. So I really, you know, as beekeeping is one sort of experience, and then to get into bee breeding is another experience that definitely they're connected. I ended up, because of working at those places where they were doing queens, started to think about, well, what queens are we making? And where do they come from and what's their story? So what many folks don't know is that there's over 20,000 kinds of bees that we know of, right? Over 4,000 of those are in North America or Turtle Island. And these are all kinds of bees, so not just honeybees. And then within New Mexico, we have, you know, about 1,400 or close, I guess, between that and 2,000 different kinds of bees here. And so honeybees are just one of those. And honeybees are like people. They were immigrated here to the Americas. There are fossil records of cousins to honeybees that were found in Nevada that are over 8 million years old. But like horses, they were here and then they were gone. And then they were reintroduced. So honeybees are here now. And when different waves of people came to the Americas, some people brought them. So we have the Spanish that came through. We have additional Europeans that came through. And not all the different kinds were brought. Within the species of just honeybees, there's 28 recognized subspecies of them. And so they can interbreed with each other, but they're very distinct. And the way they became distinct was kind of like people, where they were either isolated or connected or divided by some sort of geographical situation, whether that's mountains, a lake, an ocean, what have you. And so over time, they became very distinct subspecies. Some became very suited for tropical warm weather. Others became very suited for colder weather, like I mentioned with the South African bees that came over to the Americas. And so over time, they've become their own strains. Well, here, when we had people bringing them, only certain ones were brought, and usually from the place that they knew of, right? So we have a little bit of a mixture of bees, just like, you know, the American melting pot. You know, now we have this sort of bee melting pot, so to speak.
That was Melanie Kirby talking with Colette LaBeouf. When we come back, more from Melanie about bees in North America and her graduate degree studies.
But there's so much more. And my friends are still my friends, but there's so much more. And I never, never felt this way before.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Colette LaBeouf has been talking with Melanie Kirby, an apiculturist who established Zia Queen Bees Farm and Field Institute. After being in the field and experiencing firsthand the challenges of farmers and beekeepers, Kirby decided to pursue a graduate degree in entomology in order to help amplify the voices of farmers. Her interest in writing inspired her to apply for and receive a Fulbright Fellowship in conjunction with a National Geographic Storytelling Enhancement Award. She spent the fall of 2019 into mid-March of 2020 living and conducting research in Spain as part of her fellowship. She is now the extension educator for the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and is eager to collaborate with farmers and land stewards to designate New Mexico as a pollinator preserve, promoting biodiversity and conservation. We return to the conversation where Melanie talked about how bees have responded to human activities and the changing environments in North America.
In the 1920s, they shut the borders due to a disease called the Isle of Wight disease, but it's actually tracheal mite. So it's a little mite, microscopic, you can't see it, that will get in the tracheas of the bees and then they're not able to breathe. So they shut the borders in the 20s. And so that really cut a lot of imports of bees, which wasn't truly devastating at the time because there was bees were now here and they were becoming prolific. They were adapting and they're doing, you know, they're multiplying here in North America. But because of that, then over time and with the industrialization of agriculture, I mean, the beekeeping industry or apiculture industry was not spared. So you end up getting a handful of really large producers and they end up breeding off of the same thing over and over and over again. So I kind of draw this parallel between like potatoes. Like there's over 200 varieties of potatoes, but what are the ones we see in the store? Like maybe a handful of that, right? And so same with the bees. So American bees have to a certain degree become inbred a little bit. The genetic pool has narrowed, let's put it that way. Then you have a landscape that's been pretty ravaged in certain places, very much exploited and maybe even toxified with pesticides or whatever. And so, you know, these little creatures are being used to go pollinate all these crops. And so their genetics are compromised. Their immune system is now compromised because of this environmental impact. It's no wonder that we're seeing, you know, losses, though they're on the rise for different reasons and in different places. But all of that combined was what really inspired me, because I got to thinking about, you know, how each, even just when I draw parallel to myself, and of course, anthropomorphism is sometimes frowned upon in the scientific community, but, you know, that's how we recognize comparisons, right? Or how we go, wow, that's, there's some parallels or there's not, it diverges. And so I realized that the bees were obviously not just who they were by themselves. They're really who they are by what they interact with. Their environment is very, very much going to impress upon them positively or negatively or a combination. So I really, not only was I interested in genetics in terms of different kinds of bees, but I really started to become more fascinated with what you call epigenetics, which is looking at, you know, instead of nature versus nurture, it's actually nature nurtures and tortures. I like to add that second part on there. But it kind of shows that there's this interplay between the environment. Mm-hmm. And that's going to trigger certain expressions, genetic expressions. So various traits or characteristics will be able to adapt or not. And so I realized I'd hit a point where it was like, wow, you know, I've spent a long time learning in the field. I spent a long time learning on my own. And I really want to learn more so that I can be a better asset to my own community. I wanted to become more informed for two sort of reasons. One's a little bit covert, one's very overt. The overt one is that as a farmer, I realized what the struggles were and just how challenging they are. And the fact that between academia and the field, sometimes there's a big disconnect. The scientists want their work to be of value, but sometimes they're either stuck in a lab or that they don't know how to run field, like applied research. Then you have farmers and beekeepers, I put in that group, who see things all the time and their observations are extremely valid, but they don't have the statistics to go with it. So the scientists tend to go, well, we don't even understand what you're saying. That's just an observation. That's just hearsay. And I realized, wow, there's a real disconnect there. I want to go learn that other lingo so that then I can be a translator and help to build that bridge between the two so that we can better support each other, right? We need to be able to collaborate in that sense in order to really make a difference, at least in regards to bee health and pollinator biodiversity. And so that's when I decided to go back to school. The covert reason is that I'm an artist, I'm a poet at heart, and I really love writing. And my mother's an English teacher. So, I mean, I just have a real love of languages in general, lots of languages. And while I called myself at that time a closet academic, the way it's conveyed is very clinical. And that adds to that disconnect. And so I was like, you know, I want to be on this little secret mission to try and bring poetry back into the sciences. And I'm not the only one. So there's plenty of people who do it. And now, because things are becoming more interdisciplinary, it's exciting times, because we're able to utilize art. You know, it used to just be STEM and now it's STEAM. You know, it should have always been STEAM. Who decided to take art out? Like, that's silly. As an artist, my preferred medium is clay. Actually, I'm a ceramicist. And I feel like if I ever get another lifetime, that's what I want to really get into. Or being a chef. I love food, of course. So I went to Washington State University. And while I was there, the Fulbright program was available. And I had often thought of it, because I had thought about doing it right before I had kids, but then I had kids. And so, you know, my mind was elsewhere. And then I thought, well, maybe now that I'm back in school is the time to apply. And within the Fulbright program, you know, you have an open study research project that you're working on. So I tied that into genetics and the fact that, you know, for me, coming from New Mexico, a place which does have that tricultural tapestry, and the fact that I'm a product of that tapestry, you know, I'm mestiza, I'm a mix. And so I, on the one hand, you know, the historical traumas that we face, especially when you happen to be a product of those, you know, you can't hate yourself, right? But it made me more curious as to, okay, so what is my background, and where did all of this sort of come from that we have here in terms of our cultural aspects and our traditions, and also in regards to beekeeping? So knowing that the Spanish had been through here, and that I wanted to really sort of explore, okay, well, honeybees are endemic in Spain. They're a native bee species there. And I wanted to see, how then do these genetics work in their own home area, or in their own home region where they were derived. And so my research for my master's was actually looking at mating behavior of different subspecies of honeybees, and utilizing RFID, which is radio frequency identification. So it's a passive technology in that it doesn't require any manipulation. Basically, I'm putting a sticker on the queen's back and a little tube with an antenna around it at the entrance. And I have a little solar-powered pack that runs this little device that has a GPS unit and an SD card. And basically, when the queen flies out, the antenna picks up her tag, and it can record the date and time and the time that she went. And then it can record when she comes back. And so I can see between the different subspecies how many times they go to mate. Is it at the same? Do they all kind of go at the same time? Does one go more than the other? So I was looking at that, and then I decided to kind of tie that into my open research study for Fulbright, but looking at their bee specifically that they have there. And the Fulbright program also really encourages a cultural and traditional aspect. So for my cultural aspect, I wanted to interview beekeepers and learn more about apiculture in Spain, and see what influences are there that might have translated over here. And the world's oldest known cave paintings of honey hunters is located in Spain. So there's it's super cool. So there's a lot of history there. I mean, like, even prehistoric history of apiculture there. And that just, I found super intriguing. I'd never been to that part of the world, so I really wanted to go and learn more. And then traditionally, power tools. People used to keep bees, you know, such like my Peace Corps experience, we use machetes. And so people used to keep bees in skeps, which are baskets, in log hives, in clay tubes or clay domes. And being a ceramicist, the clay was really what kind of stuck out to me. And I wanted to learn more about that. And we also here in New Mexico have a lot of xylocopas, or the mason bees, also some of the blue orchard bees that really like adobe. And they make their home in the mud. And so that's kind of where my art inspiration is going to. I'm working with a few different artists, one of them being Roxanne Swensel from Santa Clara Pueblo. And we've already started discussing about making some clay hives out of adobe.
How cool.
Yeah. So we'll see what that happens. I mean, the coronavirus kind of curbed everything. So I was on this wonderful research exchange.
Right.
And then the pandemic hit. And so I had to come back early.
Right. So, yeah. So with your research and where you're at, so this is leading you into art also. But you're also writing about what you've discovered, or so what's next?
Good question. So my project itself, I'm still working on putting together a little podcast series with the interviews I made with the beekeepers there and several researchers. And I'm in the process of writing a couple articles about that experience in regards to industry challenges, because a lot of the challenges they experienced there, we definitely also experienced stateside. And I think Spain is the breadbasket of Europe. A lot of the northern countries and eastern Europe countries rely on Spain for a lot of their fruits and vegetables because it's a lot warmer there. And so they have a huge influx of migrants as well coming off of Africa. And so there's a lot of parallels between, you know, our region and, of course, that region. And also in terms of beekeeping, I mean, we don't have a lot of large-scale beekeepers here in our state. But there's two of them downstate that go to California to do almonds or almond pollination. We usually go out to do spring breeding projects. So to me, the bees are really like seeds, and being able to find those ones that are naturally pest and disease resistant and that remain gentle and that are productive are really like gems, you know, and I want to be able to share those. So they become sort of their own heirloom varieties, so to speak. So we share those with folks out there. And we can't start rearing, you know, they need them earlier, and we can't do it earlier here because I call it the Rocky Mountain whistle. March gets notoriously warm, and everybody gets excited, and the plants get excited, especially down in the valley, you know. And all of a sudden, then all that, as the snow melts, all that cold air comes racing down the gorge, and it just gets cold again. And so we get duped, you know, the bees get duped, especially like Velarde area. There's always a late frost. And so our springs can be volatile. We all know that we're here. And so we can't start early here. If it's too windy, it'll blow all the queens away, you know, and if it's too dry, then they won't actually want to reproduce themselves. So we really try and follow their own natural calendar. But what we can do is go other places and collaborate with other folks to help them with their own breeding program. And so that's kind of the what's next aspect is working with breeders and queen producers in different parts of the U.S. And internationally. So looking to, I wouldn't necessarily say set standards, but to come at it with a from a more mindful and respectful approach. So I'm a part of one of the inaugural founding, I guess, group members of what's called Slow Bees, which is a part of Slow Food International. I got to be a U.S. delegate for them a couple years ago and go to Italy. And so really there's a whole movement on trying to preserve artisanal heirloom and also more traditional and mindful ways of production. Mm-hmm. Slow food versus fast food, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a growing movement, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. I also, you know, having gone to school and wanting to synthesize things, you know, this is the 15-year anniversary of my farm. I love my farm. But it's never really paid me a living wage. And I know I'm not the only farmer to say that, or artist to say that, right? And so I thought to myself, you know, what can I apply my skills to better support our communities, to also provide for my family, but still in an area or in a discipline or disciplines that I really love. And so very recently I was offered the position as the extension educator for the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe.
So wonderful. So,
yeah. And, you know, ag extension is really where my heart is at, and that's what I had been hoping for. And so I mentioned to you earlier, you know, I was a little bit nervous about being there because of traffic, but in regards to the position itself, it's really kind of a dream come true because I'm getting to work with tribal communities, their neighbors, working with land-based practices, but then also integrating in modern science where appropriate. It's a really good combination. And it's at a contemporary art school. I mean, so...
Exactly.
I mean, I kind of feel like... I really feel quite surprised that...
That's great.
I mean, this was in my mind's eye. I didn't know this is what it would end up being, but...
That's great.
It found me, and I'm really glad. I guess I can say hard work pays off. I don't know. I still haven't made big bucks.
But. And also, it's a path, right?
It is. It's definitely a journey, yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
Melanie, yeah, this is so wonderful, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. Fantastic. We love hearing about what you're doing, and let us know about the podcast when we can listen to it.
Okay. I will, yeah. Okay. And through the National Young Farmers Coalition and the El Valle Farmers Group that's here in Taos, also along with the Vet Corps at the Not Forgotten Outreach and through Red Willow at Taos Pueblo, it's been really nice to interact with all of our communities here. And so I'd like to encourage everybody to plant more flowers.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much.
That was Colette LaBeouf talking with Melanie Kirby. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, SIDS Food Market, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetausradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks so much for tuning in. We've heard a few tracks from Cro-Magnon's 2017 EP, Slow Turning. Here's one more from them called One Good Reason.
Last night I was feeling
But you know I'd take a bullet for you. Yeah, but I died here before. I died here a thousand times. And now I ain't gonna lie. I know it's the last time. Yeah. Give me one good reason why I should keep on trying with you. Give me one good reason why you do the things you do. Day after day.